Is there life after football? Surviving the NFL. How do you survive the NFL nowadays? I mean, more and more information is coming out about the true damages cognitively, physically to the rest of your body, and more. We're going to hear from George Kuntz today. He's the author of Is There Life After Football? In just a few minutes, we're going to talk about Lance Armstrong, who just can't get out of his own damn way. He's disgraced himself again. Not a surprise. But, and I bring this up because of a few different reasons we'll get into later. And a lot of other good topics today. My name is Mark Farrell. The show is Insight on the Progressive Radio Network, here every Thursday from 11 to noon, right before Gary Knowles' show. Phone number is 888-874-4888. You think I'd know that number by heart, but I always have to look up to make sure I got it right. Because I never call it. You know, to know a number, you really have to dial it. 888-874-4888. So, Sports Illustrated Magazine swimsuit hits a newsstand on February 9th. But if you go online, you can see the sizzle exists right now. On the cover is the very lucky man, Derek Jeter, his girlfriend, Hannah Davis. She's the cover of Sports Illustrated. And I think she's almost wearing bikini bottoms. But that's not why I bring this up. Well, kind of like why I brought it up and why I'm showing all the people around the facilities here at PRN how lucky of a man Derek is. But I'm sure how lucky of a woman Hannah is as well, because Derek seems like a good guy. But more importantly, for the first time in history, Sports Illustrated is premiering a plus-size bikini model. And that's very, very cool for many reasons, because obviously with most models in major magazines and even in magazines like JCPenney, Sears, etc., they're very fit, thin, borderline emaciated sometimes, depends on what the actual platform is or if it's actually a model, a runway model, etc. But Ashley Graham is the lucky one. She's 27. She's size 16, which for a guy, for myself, that doesn't mean anything. But obviously, it's not like size 1 or size 0, which usually is the normal, I believe. And she's quoted saying, "There's no reason to hide and every reason to flaunt." So, Ashley, I like your perspective. And it's very cool that she is the first one after all these years of Sports Illustrated putting out this incredible magazine, which is the obviously top number one seller of magazines in the month of February, and certainly for them, Sports Illustrated. Ashley's been in a lot of top magazines, Elle, Harper's Bazaar, Glamour, Latina, and she basically, this is a quote from her, "There needs to be more education in schools because that's where eating disorders start. It's not just about being healthy. It's about loving who you are," end quote. And how true. As you know, I speak to schools and colleges and corporations nationally on a lot of different topics. And celebrating differences, self-entitlement, and understanding who you are is one of them. And I've actually spoken to a few camps, summer camps. And I think the three camps that I spoke to about being healthy and underneath the healthy umbrella is eating, making proper eating choices and decisions, were two girls' camps. They were weight loss camps and are educating the campers about, you know, eating healthy and obviously being immersed in society where it's all about appearance, especially in the social media age where everyone is taking selfies and of themselves in a mirror and bikinis, underwear, poolside, oceanside, and just flaunting their fitness. So it's very important because you have to understand that you don't have to live up to societal expectations to be happy. And certainly healthy is very, very important. But if you're, you know, 10, 15, 20 pounds, 30 pounds overweight, and you're healthy, you can be overweight and still be healthy. But more importantly, you know, be happy. That's very, very important. So Graham, actually, the model who is appearing, the plus-size model who's appearing in Sports Illustrated, Ashley Graham, also recently slammed Hollywood for using Jennifer Lawrence as a curvy girl role model. Now, Jennifer Lawrence is a banging woman. She is very, very attractive. But she is far from a plus-size model, as Graham says, she's tiny. She is. I mean, if you put her up next to Ashley Graham. Now, Ashley Graham, you can see her pictures online. And again, this magazine, Sports Illustrated swimsuit model issue is coming out to newsstands February 9th. She is, number one, a gorgeous woman. And she appears to be very content. You know, you can look at someone's eyes, you know, the old saying, windows to the soul. But she seems very, very comfortable in her own skin and the little attire that she's wearing. But it's so very true that she is gorgeous. I mean, her body is just gorgeous. She's curvy. And it's just a great first step. And I really hope that this really opens a door and further conversation and consideration for other major media outlets, especially magazines, digital, online, to feature plus size models. Size 16, I don't know where the plus size begins. Maybe anything over 10, 12, I'm not sure. If you're a listener and you know this answer, you can give us a call and let us know, 888-874-4888. But I think it's a great step. And on that note, I was very, very happy to see during the Super Bowl. First of all, great game. Wow. One of the best Super Bowls I've ever seen. I was totally deflated by the outcome, like many were. But that's another story. We'll get into that with George Kuntz when we talk about Life After the NFL, his new book, in just a few minutes. But there were a lot of great ads. A lot of them were tugging on your heartstrings. And I'm not going to get into them because we've heard all about this and you've been talked out, I'm sure, about this. But in conjunction with the Sports Illustrated plus size model, Ashley Graham, I think it's a good thing to make a segue and point out to the commercial Like a Girl. The Super Bowl ad that shows how basically the word girl has a weak and negative connotation, a stereotype, bad. And a video that they show that says, you know, how do you throw like a girl? How do you fight like a girl? How do you run like a girl? So adolescent girls, older women and boys were asked how to mimic that. And they did. And they looked very foolish because in their minds, this is what they imagine and picture girls and or women to throw like. Now, contrast to prepubescent girls, though, that would be 10 and younger, who were asked to do the same thing, throw, hit, fight, etc., like a girl. They did it like a boy would do it. You know, we're fighting, air fighting, and running fast and not in a very uncoordinated manner or silly manner. So to them, running like a girl meant just running like who they are themselves. And that's very, very cool. Because I didn't know this, but, you know, doing a little bit of research, that girls' self-confidence drops substantially during puberty. Very interesting. I guess it must be the estrogen or the development of estrogen in the brain that throws off the brain chemistry, which has an impact, an effect on perception, internal perception, confidence, who we think we are. But I think it was a great message. And it's also the advertiser is always a feminine products manufacturer. And I thought they did a magnificent job because what a great platform, especially it's great because we're talking about football today, to, number one, show girls the fact that they have the power to be who they are, what they want to be, and you don't have to conjure up these stereotypes or images in your mind of what a girl does in terms of running, fighting, etc. And I think even more importantly, that it shows a very male-dominated audience for the football game, the biggest game of the year, Super Bowl. And as a matter of fact, I think it was the number one viewed Super Bowl in all of its history, television history. So this is even a better plus because the gargantuan audience saw firsthandedly how important it is to realize the importance. I think I said importance twice, didn't I? Well, it's very important that girls are just like boys. You know, they don't have to have this image of just being like a almost like a foe or a deer, just kind of uncoordinated. That's not true at all. Yes, anybody can be uncoordinated and untrained and kind of gawky and, growing into their body when they're young. But the fact that we have this negative connotation and or image in our minds that all girls and or women are like that is far from true. I mean, actually, I think it's more for younger girls, prepubescent and girls going through in their early teens, because we see so many commercials of women who empower and are emboldened and have conquered so much in sport. And we're actually gaining ground in the workplace as well, which is nice. There are not nearly as many CEOs or women of high-ranking positions in the world of corporations, and that's got to change. I see more and more positive steps being taken online, and I think I'm not a huge fan of social media in terms of – because I think a lot of people just use it incorrectly. I use it not for personal reasons. I use it just for professional reasons, talking about this show and my speaking engagements, etc. But a lot of people, I think, use it as a way to just have company, which is kind of sad. And I think that's the wrong way to feel a false form of empowerment by other your Facebook world friends saying, you can do it, you look great, et cetera, et cetera. So I digress, but the point I want to bring up is that there are so many different things out there and so many people doing great posts about why women are empowered and the great strides that they are making. And I hope in our next administration, whoever that may be at the helm of this country, that this could be something that they could also spearhead as well as an initiative. The wife of the president and or the president himself. I think this would be something of very great importance. So I applaud always the women's feminine product company. They did a lot of research on this, and it shows. The commercials were tastefully done, very effective, and I think the feedback was very, very good. Actually, I know that because it's been stated in newspaper and online that it was very well received. Because, number one, we always like to see people doing sports during a sports particular program. And what better program than the Super Bowl? And the fact that it was very compelling, showing boys trying to pretend like they're throwing like girls and girls trying to pretend like, you know, throw like a girl, like you envision, like you've been told you should throw like a girl. And then how it comes around full form to realize that, wow, prepubescent girls throw like they want to throw and run like they want to throw like themselves. And that's great stuff. Speaking of great stuff, it was a great game. And last week, this is actually going to seem like a NFL football-related program, because last week we had the great George Martin, New York Giants great. 14 years with the New York Giants, Super Bowl champion, et cetera, on the show. And today we have another great NFL star, George Kuntz Jr., who's written a phenomenal book, Is There Life After Football? Surviving the NFL. So when I heard about this book, it just came out, maybe about 3 weeks ago, and we'll get to the publisher, et cetera, and where it's available. It's available everywhere. But I realized the significance of this book, because this is the first book that really breaks ground on what happens before you get into the NFL for players during college. And once you get into the NFL, the bubble that you're in, this life, this falsification of being an NFL player. And by the way, I never realized the acronym NFL. A lot of people, the players, say it stands for not for long. And that seems quite true. And then most importantly, about life after the NFL. You know, you basically put on your own devices and say, okay, thank you, go. And how this needs to change. This is a great book, a lot of interviews with over 100 players. And I'd like to welcome the very, very fantastic George Kuntz to the program. Hey, George, how are you?
I'm doing good, Mark. Thank you for having me on.
Oh, my pleasure, my friend. This is a really, really great work, and I congratulate you on this piece.
I appreciate it. It took some time, and I have a lot of sweat equity in that book as well, because you know each chapter, I kind of give the jump off point using my my personal experience as a lead in for each chapter, and trying to shed some light on some really important issues and challenges and stumbling blocks that players go through.
And I'm so glad you've decided to do this. And not only do you weave your personal story along and in between the lives of many, many great players, and average players as well, but you did this along with two Marquette University sociologists, James Holston and Richard Jones. And I think that brings an added flavor of credibility, science, and a different perspective versus just somebody, not just somebody, but a former NFL player who played for a decade, won a Super Bowl with the Green Bay Packers, and has a lot to say, but also gives a, just a lot more validity.
Yeah, I think so. It gives it that from a theoretical piece, and then we have a practical piece as well. And I was able to team up with two outstanding sociologists over at Marquette University. They kind of helped me along my way. It took me about 6 years to get my PhD, and they were very instrumental in giving me the framework in which I needed to go to make that happen, to make that become a reality. And we all collaborated and say, look, we've been working well. They kind of guided me on my dissertation, and I said, George, let's talk about a book where we can help some people.
Great. You know, I was remiss in introducing you the correct way. Dr. Kuntz.
Oh, no, no.
But I like the sound of that.
No, I like George better.
No, so do I. But you know what? It's great. You worked really, really hard. And currently you're the VP of Advancement at Merriam University. And we're going to get to all this. But do me a favor. I really enjoyed your book on so many different levels. And guess what? I was going to lend this book out. But I realize that there's so many people I want to lend this book out. I'm not going to be able to. I'm just going to have to buy copies for them because I think there's so much valuable information, whether you're a diehard football fan or someone who's just into current events, because obviously the NFL has been just in the hot seat, justifiably, for the last year, year and a half. But what in particular struck me is that when I opened the book and I read the preface, et cetera, got into chapter one, I loved how sad but your life realization about when you realized it was over. So please talk about that and your banter and or what took place with your wife.
Well, yeah, playing in the National Football League was a dream come true and something that I dreamed of as a little boy growing up in Eastern North Carolina in a socially economically deprived neighborhood in New Bern, North Carolina. I started playing when I was 9 and was very fortunate to play until I was 32. But when my playing days was over with, I was kind of lost. And I felt like I didn't have a purpose. I kind of lost my passion. I drifted over in depression, deep depression. And after about, some binge drinking at the beach for about maybe 4 or 5 days, I decided to go around a 25 miles per hour curve mark, going about probably 75, and luckily I'm still here. My wife said, George, we can't reinvent who you are. We just have to redefine who you are because your purpose in life isn't to run around on a football field with a helmet trying to hit people. I think, George, your purpose is to try to change neighborhoods. Try to make neighborhoods better in which you found them, and try to give other students an opportunity to live out the American dream like you did, and giving them a chance to get a college education. So I started trying to, at that point, after that accident, went back to school. First of all, I had to brush myself off.
Sure.
Started going back to school, and I've been trying to raise money ever since. Been raising money for the last 11, 12 years, trying to give some students, smart, deserving, good-looking students, a shot at the American dream that we all know so well, Mark.
And I'd just like to add a footnote to that you were told when you were cut from the Seahawks, I believe it was, hey, George, stay fit. Because you know what? Your phone's going to ring. Maybe not from us, but there's a lot of other teams who know who you are. You're a great player. Your stats are great, impressive throughout the decade that you played. So for 2 years, you had this false idea that, and it could have happened, but it didn't happen, that your phone was going to ring and that you're going to be lured back in. So I guess it really came to a head when you jumped in your Suburban and you went to the beach for a couple of days, and then you had that realization. But what I like is that, you know, we all go through periods of life where we think that something's going to happen, and for whatever of series of events that does or does not happen for us, we realize, okay, time to change the roadmap here.
Most definitely, you know, one thing about life, if you live long enough, you're going to go through a storm. You're going to go through a rough patch.
Yeah,
you know,
man.
And I came to a point where I came to the fork in the road, and instead of going left or right, I went straight ahead, and I had to try to figure life out, and I've been able to do that since that accident. But I've had to really get counseling and get a support system around me, and I've been off and running ever since.
Fantastic, and the trajectory for yourself and for, it seems like, the majority of retired NFL players seem just like the path you took, straight ahead, because that's the only thing you knew to do. And that's why I'd like to ask you about the NFL bubble. And it starts even pre-NFL. And talk about that and how living in a bubble is just so disillusional, as well as, you know, setting you up for a gargantuan fall.
Right. You know, NFL players live in a distinctive world of their own. You know, a lot of them refer to it. I know in the locker room we refer to it as the bubble. You know, we're kind of immersed in a cultural or structural or psychological experimental world that kind of insulates us from everyone else.
And that's purposeful?
Yes, I think. Oh, yeah. I think it's...
For the cohesion?
Mm-hmm.
Team spirit.
I think that the organization, the coaches, the administrators kind of want to, you know, have control to make sure that we getting, you know, the proper training, the proper coaching, our proper rest, because they feel like if they can control that, they may have an influence on the outcome. And we all know, Mark, that the outcome is to win football games.
As every coach eats, lives, and breathes for.
Right.
That's the bottom line. So talk about more of the bubble. I mean, how does this start? I mean, you said you started playing at age 9, and I was actually just playing with some sports the other day with some friends of mine who have some kids that are older who are 13, 14, and they're already telling me, and I guess this is new news for me, but not for most of the American audience listening, that it starts already at that age how coaches from different districts are vying to get other players, and they do things not by the books. And, of course, the parents get involved, and it becomes ugly, and it seems like this cycle already starts. And then, of course, then the gifted guys get more preferential treatment, and that's just the beginning of it. And then, of course, you get into college, and then and so on.
Right. You're exactly right. I started, like you said, I probably entered into the bubble when I was 9 years old. It didn't take you no more than in probably about 30 minutes seeing me running around on the practice field or on the game field on a Saturday afternoon with the rest of the kids. And you probably said, well, that guy right there, number 53, he's something special. And that's okay. And that's a great compliment. Mm. And as I moved from, you know, youth football to middle school to high school, college, and to the pros, I was treated as though I was special. But the thing, and that's okay. But what, you know, where you go wrong is when you start expecting to be be treated special. That's where you start to have issues and challenges and problems. And when you start expecting that, you know, it's your right to be giving certain things, and a lot of players lose sight that it's a privilege to play on Friday night or Saturday night or Sunday night or Monday night, and a lot of times you know, you have to hit rock bottom to realize that, you know, a lot of times you think that, you know, football is life. Football is not life. Football is an outstanding sport. It's a spectacular sport, a sport that I love dearly. And I get a lot of enjoyment out of watching it and at one point playing it. But everyday life is life is when you lose your wife at 38 years old you know, she has two kids and a husband. Or your father passes away when you're 27 years old and you guys never got to the point where you never told each other that you loved them. Now, that's life.
Absolutely.
You know, but I do know, Mark, that if you can get life right, it can help carry you over to make whatever sport you're playing or your job, your career, better.
Now, I don't know the stats, and maybe this is in a book and I didn't get to this, George, but what are the numbers, percentages of NFL players that get drafted before they finish college?
Well, I do know that there's probably about, let's say, 1,900, you know, between 1,900, 2,100 football players in the National Football League, and 60% of the players have their college degree. There's about 18,000 around our country, and about 80% of them have their college degree.
It's a pretty good number.
For the most part, football players are pretty smart, but we have the most issues and problems out of any other major league sport, such as hockey, football, you know, hockey, baseball, or basketball. You know, so
I was in awe, George, to find out that every year there's about a 30% or a third turnover in the NFL.
Right,
that's a big number.
Yep, because like you said earlier, Mark, that the NFL is an acronym for basically yeah. saying not for long, and that's true because the average football player plays 3.5 years, and every player thinks that they're going to play, you know, 10 to 15 years because you know, go back to when you was playing in youth football or middle school or high school or college, you're the best on your team in youth football, and you're the best in middle school and high school and in college. And so when you get to the pros, you don't think you're going to be average. You think you're going to play, you know, 10 or 15 years. And we all know that number, one thing about statistics over the long haul, they're going to hold true. And the average player plays 3.5.
But you were an aberration back then when you retired. Super Bowl championship in 1997, which is great to have on your belt. I'm sure that was a dream come true. But even nowadays, I mean, at the span is, I think, 4.2 or 4.5 years average lifespan. So did you feel that you were indomitable after your fifth, sixth, seventh year? And did you have in your mindset how many years you wanted to go for? And did you want to finish on top?
Yeah, I wanted to finish on top. I wanted to walk away when I wanted to step aside. I thought I was going to play at the minimum 10 years. And if I reflect over my career and think of one thing that I might say I missed the mark on, and it was not playing for 10, but playing for 9 years in the National Football League. I played 10 years professionally because I played in NFL Europe for a year. But a lot of players think as though, you know, they're going to play forever. And I was no different.
Physically and possibly mentally, when do you think you should have retired?
Well, when I look back, I kind of felt like I still had it. You know, when I was thinking about when I was 32 years old, I felt pretty good. And at that time, I had already sustained about 11 concussions.
11?
Mm-hmm. 7 surgeries. And I thought that I felt pretty good. But when I look at tapes now, I could tell that there was a big difference from playing at my ninth year in the league compared to my second or third year in the league, there was a big difference in speed and the reaction time and things like that.
I mean, as a linebacker, that's a brutal position. I mean, you played three different linebacking positions as well.
Yep. I was very fortunate. I was pretty versatile. I could play inside and outside, and I was able to play all three linebacker positions. But all I wanted to do was just help my team win a football game. I love to compete. So if I needed to put in extra time to study the different positions to make sure that I could help my team win, I did it. I didn't have a problem putting in the time.
When you were in a locker room, I'm sure, and that's a whole different culture and probably worth an interview of itself. But did you see a lot of things that you were dismayed about in terms of, or were you in that bubble as well in terms of the amount of shots and pills and drugs and medication and maybe not all the true and accurate information being told to the your fellow teammates from the doctors?
Well, you see it all. You know, I know one thing about players, they try to do everything they can to stay on the field. So if they have an injury or they're hurting, they're going to take whatever medication they can get their hands on.
So it's a two-way street.
Mm-hmm. Yep. But it's going to come back to hurt you at some point.
Absolutely. You know? And as Jim McMahon said that, I mean, he said he would just have a whole cocktail of pills and hundreds of shots. And Mike Ditka confirmed that and said that's just the way it was and just the way it is and not happy about it. And you talk about Jim. Jim is in your book, and it's unfortunate that he's experiencing a lot of premature dementia at his age.
Right. And I was very, very fortunate to have played with Jim McMahon. I had a chance to watch him when I was in college when he was playing for the Chicago Bears, and then in 1996, he came over to the Packers, and I had a chance to build a friendship with him. He's a great guy. It's very, very unfortunate that, you know, he's probably around, 52, 53 years old.
Mm.
He spends the majority of his day going back and forth. He's out in Arizona. He spends the majority of his day going back and forth to the mailbox because he forgot that he got his mail, and that's heartbreaking.
It really
is. You know,
is.
To know, you know, that someone that young is going through what he's going through.
I guess the only upside for him is that he does have periods of time where he's very lucid.
Yep.
For now.
So that's good. I wish him the best. I know he was an excellent teammate. He really kept the locker room really loose. He has a great personality, and I hope he's I don't know if there's a cure out there for dementia or Alzheimer's, but if there isn't, I hope that we find one soon, because he's a great guy.
When you were playing in the NFL, did you or any of your teammates come across any former players? Because, I mean, that's what they live for, to come back and get into that collegial feeling of just being in the locker room and the playoffs and the Super Bowl, et cetera. And would you see some of these retired players, whether they played on your team or not, and be like, wow, this is my future? Look at these guys.
Well, you're talking about current, you're talking about guys that aspire to be in the National Football League, or you're talking about former guys?
When you were actually playing and you would see retired guys, your future, would it be something that would scare you because you'd see some of these guys cognitively not there?
Well, Mark, I can remember so vividly back in my first year in the league. I was on the field warming up. We were in Lambeau, and the Packers, we were playing the Chicago Bears, and it was alumni week. And an alumni weekend is when they invite all former Packer players back to the game, and they bring them on the field before the game, and they recognize them to the crowd. And I was telling one of my teammates, a linebacker as well, a guy by the name of Johnny Holland from Texas A&M.
Sure.
I said, Johnny, look at those guys. Look how they're walking. And I was laughing. I was laughing at the guys, and I said, "They got look at that guy. He has a cane. He's walking with a cane." And Johnny grabbed me and said, "Look, hey, Koontz, that's going to be us one day."
Wow.
I said, "What are you talking about?" And I got upset. I said, "We're not going to be like that." And Johnny was exactly right, because one of my teammates, a guy by the name of Cletus Hunt, he's out of Memphis, came to the Packers back in 1999. He's probably about 38 years old right now, 39 years old. He's had both hips replaced, you know. So, you know, one thing about football, it is a tough, tough sport. But as Americans, we truly love that sport.
Yeah, it's brutal. It's brutal when you're playing it, and brutal when you're finished it. When you're finished with the game, because it's not finished with you, unfortunately, physically right. And mentally.
True.
So now that's the segue. Now, what do you think? Do you think the game, obviously, they're making different rules and regulations, changing a bit? I mean, it's never going to change. It's always going to be a very, very dangerous sport. These guys are like titans. They're like Adonises, you know, the size and sheer force and strength of these guys. But is there anything that you think that can be done, or is the NFL doing enough? I mean, they're really in the crosshairs of the public right now. So if there is ever a time, now's the time for them to make a change, implementation-wise.
Yeah, and they are. But it's going to take some time. Because, you know, when you look at the history of the sport, back in 1905, over 19 young men died playing football. And that's when Teddy Roosevelt, he was the president at the time, he called Harvard, Yale, and Princeton to the White House, and they implemented some things from the discussions and conversations that they had back in 1905. And next thing you know, the NCAA was born. And then, you know, I came to the National Football League in the early 90s, and a couple guys was paralyzed. Dennis Berg from the Jets, and
that's right.
Mike Utley from the New York from the Detroit Lions. And then in the 2000s, you heard about a guy from the Minnesota Vikings, Corey Stringer, died because of dehydration. And now we're on to concussions. And I think that they're going to implement some things, change the way that we tackle, try to take the head out of the sport. And I think it's just a matter of time that things starts to get better, but it's gonna take a few years.
I mean, when you hear about the junior Sals in the world, and thankfully that's an aberration, an anomaly. But the fact that he had the wherewithal, people could say, "Oh, he was just depressed and just crazy." But the fact that, you know, his letter, and this was made public, and his son had made public of portions of the letter that. You know, he shot himself in the chest, so his brain could be given to the brain bank because he knew there was something seriously wrong, and it was due to his tenure in football.
Right. Those subcuffs hits. You know, I know one of the guys that went to East Carolina University, the university that I attended to, a guy by the name of Terry Long. He took his life. You know, Dave Duerson, mm-hmm. Notre Dame. You know, he was on the board of trustees at Notre Dame. He shot himself in the chest as well. So, but we have to do some things to protect the players, because we have to make sure those guys are able to play a game that they love, but also live a long and fruitful life as well.
Is there life after football? Surviving the NFL. On the phone with me is George Koontz Jr., Super Bowl champion and author and a doctor. Anything else am I missing there? Did I get everything there?
I'm cold.
Oh, you're cold. Oh, you're not
in Wisconsin.
You're not in New York City, man. Oh, what's the temperature there?
About 3 degrees.
Oh.
Three degrees. So I think we have the Big Apple beat.
Yeah, you do. We're getting some Arctic wind tonight, but I don't think we're going to reach down to three. That's pretty serious, boy. Oof.
Right.
So now, of course, the trajectory of your book is post-NFL. And these in the bubble period, pre-NFL, during the NFL, and then the bubble burst right after you retire, because most of the things were handled for you. You had a financial analyst. I'm not saying possibly you or yourself, but mostly for the players. It's a misnomer, I think, for the average players how much money they made. Maybe they made proper investments. Maybe they live an incredibly opulent life and don't have much money to live on after 2-3 years outside the NFL. They're kind of tapped. People get surprised by this, but knowing all the background, maybe how they were brought up, not being educated with a financial acumen, et cetera, it's no surprise that they end up where they end up, on broke street, depressed, physically hurt, and directionless.
Right, right. You know, all those things happen to former players, you know. They're kind of thrust out of the bubble. You know, you don't really leave on your own accord. You don't volunteer to live out of the bubble. They kind of push you aside. And then you're out of that locker room culture. And, you know, it's a huge difference from the way things operate inside the locker room than the way the things happen in everyday life. And a lot of players was protected from the mundane things of everyday life, such as, you know, balancing a checkbook and things of that nature. And also, too, those players are young, where most people are retiring at the age of 65. You know, players are retiring from the sport at 25, 26 years old. And they go through the whole loss of identity. And whenever a piece of you die, there's a grieving process that takes place. And
true.
And one thing about that, a lot of guys get stuck in the depression stage.
There's a lot of great aspects to the book. If the in your eyes and in my eyes, I think probably the most significant takeaway in your book is their life after football, surviving the NFL, is that yes, you can. But you have to, whether it's the redefining aspect, it takes a lot of work, maybe not as much work as it took you to get into the NFL and maintain a coveted position, but it is possible.
Most definitely, because one thing I think is why so many people, this book resonates with so many people, because they can substitute, you know, is their life after football, you can substitute you know, the police department, you could substitute a school teacher, you could substitute volleyball, and basketball and so forth and so on. Whenever you're in a particular role for an extended period of time, when you leave that role, there's going to be a loss of identity, and you're going to go through some different stages of grieving, but you just have to make sure that you have a great support system around you, and stay busy and keep your faith intact, and things going to be fine.
What do you attribute to you keeping your head on straight and coming out of the football NFL, you know, not broke, not obviously distraught because of the matters and actions that we discuss, which is quite normal, but and also would you suggest that anyone who's considering to be a pro athlete read this?
I would suggest not just players that have aspirations to or dream to play professionally, but their parents as well, because 70% of the players in the National Football League are first generation, they're first in their families to go to college, and or they come from low income families, so. All of this is new, and one thing about playing professionally is part of the story of this great nation that we live in. You can go from rags to riches,
seemingly overnight. Sure.
Yep. You just need someone to help you, to coach you, and guide you along your way.
Did you have a mentor back then?
I did, but sometimes you need mentors as you move on to different phases. And
sure.
Different. You know, steps in your life, your mentors are going to have to change. So I have a great support system right now. some outstanding people here in Wisconsin, Milwaukee, that have really invested in me as a person.
When you watch modern games today and the players like Ray Rice, Michael Vick, Plaxico, what goes through your mind? Do you just shake your head and say, hey, really, get your act together, pal?
Well, yeah, but also, too, I think about how young they are.
Yeah.
You know, because a lot, you know, players are given a lot at a very a young age. And I don't care what family you come from or what side of the tracks you come from, given tens of millions of dollars, it's not a guarantee that that we all would act appropriately.
Mm. Yeah, look at Justin Bieber.
Right. It doesn't matter.
No.
That's a lot. You know, guys are making, you know, millions of dollars, 22, 23 years old. And a lot of them don't even really understand the magnitude of the money they're dealing with. So so a lot of it is maturity. But if you make one wrong step, it can hurt you for a lifetime.
How many players are understandably realistic about how their shelf life is so short and how dispensable they are?
They really don't have an understanding. Like we talked about earlier, a lot of players think they're going to play, they're going to play for 10, 15 years and they're going to walk away from the sport when they want to walk away from the sport. But the NFL isn't built that way. You know, with the non-guaranteed contracts and things like that, you know, it's from 1 week to the next week, from 1 month to the next month. You can't say, well, I'm guaranteed to play 10 years or 5 years. That's not going to happen. Not in the National Football League.
And I would be remiss if I don't talk about one of the most glorious times in your life, and certainly a week after the Super Bowl. How did it feel to play in Super Bowl 31?
It was unbelievable, growing up in Eastern North Carolina, having a chance to, live out a dream and compete and travel throughout the United States and stay in really nice hotels and really nice and play in really nice stadiums to all that to come and culminate into me playing in Super Bowl 31 out in New Orleans and coming away with the win. It was huge. It was huge. And because unfortunately the next year we went back and we lost, so I know how it feels to win one and lose one, and it really, really feels good to win a Super Bowl.
You think it's harder to win and then lose versus lose and then win the
wow.
Super Bowl?
Well, I'd rather win one first.
Yeah, so exactly. Oh, okay, yeah. Good point. Okay.
Yeah, if I would have if I had to write that script, I'll write it so we win one first, and then we would come back and get complacent and lose the next one. If I had to write it that way.
So, George, this past Sunday's game, no matter who you were rooting for, could you believe the second-to-last play? Or
I should say
the last play, I should say, from Seattle.
Yeah, it was unbelievable. I've heard a lot of commentators, and I read the papers from time to time, and they talk about the play call. But what I like to think about is that young man, Malcolm Butler, from West Alabama, was working at Popeyes not too long ago.
That's great.
Went to a couple community colleges. He just wanted an opportunity. He studied. He did his homework. He made an outstanding play. He will be etched in the memories in New England and Boston,
cemented
sports history for the rest of eternity. So I'm so happy for him. I know a lot of people say, "Well, it was a bad call." I thought it was a great call. I thought it was a great play on his behalf. Let's give him his due and let's give him credit.
And I certainly don't want to have you or put you in a position where you want to speak wrongly or about anyone or particular coach or et cetera, but was there ever a time when you got into a huddle and you heard the play call or you knew what was going down and or on the sidelines and you're shaking your head going, why in the world would they make that call?
Well, sometimes, I wouldn't be human if I didn't say, that I didn't agree, but I didn't agree with every play call that came in from the sidelines. I was very, very fortunate and privileged to be able to call the plays for the Packers from a defensive perspective. And sometimes plays would come in and I was like, why are we going to call that? But I trusted in the system. I trusted in the coaches. I trusted my teammates beside me. And the majority of the time, things worked out because I believed in my teammates and my organization.
And very quickly, two last points, George, before I let you go so you can turn up that thermostat.
Yep.
Now, you did have a chance to work with an NFL organization not suited up. How did that feel?
It felt great to be able to be on the opposite side, to see it from a different lens. And I had a chance to be in the locker room and then to come back and see it from a director of player development working in the front office with the Packers. That was a great opportunity.
But that wasn't learning. Enough for you.
No, it was a great learning experience. But even when I had that position up in Green Bay, I was driving every Tuesday and Thursday night to night classes at Marquette University. It was about a 4-hour round trip. 2 hours one way, trying to fulfill a dream, trying to make my mom proud of me and my wife proud of me and the kids. I just wanted to get a PhD. I'm the first in my family to receive a PhD. And,
fantastic.
And trying to set the bar that my kids and my brothers and sisters would try to reach at some point.
I don't know how old your children are and or if you have boys in particular. It's kind of a sexist statement because girls do play football. But have you and would you let your children play football?
Well, my son is he's 8 years old. I would love for him to play football, but he says, Mark, he said he wants to be a bishop. So
wow.
So hopefully, his dream can come true and hopefully I get a chance to see it. But if he wanted to. If he wants to play football, I'm all for it because I really truly believe that the positives outweigh the negatives when it comes to football. His dad is doing okay now,
Yeah. Now, did your draw hit the floor when your son said, Dad, I think I want to be a bishop? In utter dismay?
Well we kind of figured that when he was like 2 years old. He was he loved the windows and the different churches and things like that. So he was fascinated by, the architecture of the different buildings of churches. So
the whole vibe.
But then
great.
He kind of grew, and we put him in. He's been going to Catholic school, so he's in the third grade now, and he does mass. He's going to be something you're going to hear about him one day.
Sounds so. Well, for George Koontz, it sounds like there's certainly life well after football, and you did more than survive the NFL. Your book is available everywhere. Do you have a website?
No, I do not, but you can go to NYU Press, nyupress.com, and the book is there. But I'm on Facebook, but I just want to thank you for having me on and in the big city, the Big Apple.
Are you going to be coming this way soon for any press junkets or signings?
I'm going to try to get down, get to the Big Apple in this summer or this spring. I'm going to be at Harvard in July taking classes over there, so maybe I can come over to the city and we can get together, have a cup of coffee.
Love to.
Maybe have a book signed.
And very quickly, what's one of the classes you're going to be taking at Harvard?
Well, there's a higher education. It's the Institute of Educational Management. It's a special program.
Good for you.
So I want to try to take my professional development to the next level and see what happens. Maybe I can be a number two on a campus one day. You never know.
Hey, George Koontz, you're a shining example. Thank you, my friend.
Thank you, Mark. Bye-bye.
Have a great day. Stay warm, my friend.
Bye-bye.
And we're almost out of time, but I really want to get to this very quickly. Lance Armstrong, you know, stripped of his 7 Tour de France wins, lifetime ban from pro cycling. And now he can add this to his resume. Hit and run driver. Yeah, on December 29th in Aspen. He had a few too many hits from the bottle, slammed into 2 cars, but he convinced his girlfriend, cajoled his girlfriend, Anna Hansen, to switch seats. So very quickly that they returned to the scene of the crime, Anna did on foot to tell the drivers of the parked cars that she would repair and pay for the repairs, et cetera, et cetera. And then the investigator of Aspen Police Department said, you know, this doesn't just seem right, you know. I guess maybe he knew who she was, et cetera. Found out, of course, that Mr. Lance Armstrong disgraced himself once again when he came out of the museum cocktail party. He did get behind the wheel. The valet drivers and door workers confirmed that they actually put his girlfriend, who was seemed sober, in the passenger seat. But, of course, he convinced her to take the fall, just like everyone else in the path of Lance Armstrong. Wow. Way to go, Lance. I guess change is not in your future. My name is Mark Farrell. This show is available always of podcasts at PRN.fm. Check out Insight. My contact information to have me speak at your school, organization, etc. is MarkFarrellMotivation.com. My website, MarkFarrellMotivation.com. Have a great day. Stay warm and happy wherever you are.